many a time, even though the preparations are well contemplated and the processes have been well thought out, when you actually come to the forefront of the task, you will find that it is a terrible thing that is before. This is what happened to Arjuna, as described in the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. It was all a grand preparation for the practice of yoga, a glorious proclamation of the war of the spirit that is to take place, and a tremendous contemplation in all its intricacies has been worked out. But when the forces were confronted in the field of battle, it was enough to give a shock to the entire personality of Arjuna. Now this Arjuna is everyone in the world. Every individual is an Arjuna, an individual, a seeker, a soldier in the battlefield of spiritual practice. All your preparations go in vain when you actually confront the terror that is in front of you. When I go to the jungle, I will meet the lion. What is there? You will see here. In the room you can speak like that. I will show my gun. I will give a clout on its head. I will draw my spear. But when it opens its mouth in front of you, oh God, you run for your life. This lion is not the one that I thought in my room. This is something different. All your preparations go to the winds, because the idealistic preparation, which is merely a thought process, though honestly entertained within oneself, is a little different from the very same thing when it is connected with the realistic pattern of the world. The world is not merely an individual idea, though the idea of the individual has something to do with the objects of the world. In the practice of yoga, we should not be one-sided. As I have been mentioning some time back, we should not lean too much either on the side of our own thoughts and feelings entirely to the exclusion of the facts of the outside world, nor should we lean too much on the world outside, completely ignorant of what is happening to us within our own selves. The subject and the object have to be correlated in the practice of yoga. As a matter of fact, the universal is nothing but such a correlation. The universal is neither a subject nor an object. It is both things blended in such a manner that no individual can imagine what it is. So in the beginning of yoga, at the very outset, when you are seated and put forth effort to contemplate you will find that you are at sea. What is that on which you have to contemplate? Then the doubts arise in the mind. One of the greatest dangers to the spiritual quest is doubt in the mind. Doubts of various types. One of the doubts is, am I properly prepared for this task ahead of me? There may be a suspicion which tells you from inside you that perhaps you are not up to the task. I have made a mistake. This thought occurs to the minds of seekers in a short time after they have severed themselves from relationship with what they regarded as bondage in the world. It may be homestead and chattel, whatever it is. A second doubt may arise in the mind. Is the technique that I am adopting in my practice okay? Or is there something wrong in the technique? Is it capable of piercing through the truth? The third doubt may come. Is the master who has initiated me competent, or should I have gone to a better one, more competent than one, and a more advanced one? But the greatest of doubts is something different. This was the doubt of Arjuna. He had three doubts in his mind, which he expressed to Lord Shri Krishna. And this is the doubt coming in a threefold form to every seeker of truth. One of the doubts is, will I succeed? Because I am a single person. And the problems before me seem to be so vast. And have I the courage and the power to face these problems? Sri Krishna was queried by Arjuna. What is the guarantee that we will win victory? Whereas the other side also may win victory. Then what is the purpose? What is the good of all this? Secondly, a very subtle social sense of ethics enters the mind. What will happen to my wife? What about my children who are not fixed up? What about the opprobrium that will be cast upon me? Am I a selfish person who is seeking an individual salvation? While the whole world is in agony and sorrow, this was another doubt of Arjuna. We will be creating a chaos in the world by entering into this war. The consequence of this battle would be a terrible chaos, confusion in the entire human society. Also, is it worthwhile to break traditions, uproot temples of sacred worship, and defy all the rules and regulations of human society, which are held in high sacred esteem, the bonds of affection among people, this is also a doubt of attitude. These doubts do not come on the very first day. They come after a few months. And they are enough to shake a person out of the roots. Now, these doubts arise because the initial enthusiasm which has driven a seeker to the path of yoga. This enthusiasm has not been backed up with sufficient understanding. We are mostly emotional people. Every one of us has an emotion. And when emotion gains an upper hand, we get into a mood and take steps which on sober occasions we would have hesitated to take. When you hear a powerful discourse by an experienced Mahatma on the nature of God, or the glory of spiritual salvation, you can be fired up with the zeal of leaving everything and throwing out all things and getting out from bondage. But this is an enthusiasm, which is good as far as it goes. Because it is a spiritual enthusiasm, we should regard it as good only. But it is not merely goodness that counts in this world. There are other things which have to be combined with goodness. Goodness is one of the features and characters of the human nature. But there are other characters which you should not ignore and which are equally important. You have a body, you are a biological individual. And the body has its own urges. You have a subconscious layer of mind which will have its own say at one time or the other, but which for the time being has been buried underneath by the pressure of the conscious activity of the mind at the present moment. And there is what is called the social sense in a human being, which is not a feeble bond, but a very strong bond, but which can be submerged again by emotions of a different type when they gain an upper hand. There is nothing unimportant within us. Everything is important when it comes up to the surface and demands recognition. You cannot say hunger is unimportant, thirst is unimportant, sleep is unimportant. You cannot say that human affections are unimportant. Well, they may all look meaningless from the point of your spiritual aspiration, but they are not unimportant from their own point of view. It is necessary, therefore, to judge things from their own point of view and not from another person's point of view or some other standpoint altogether, which may be irrelevant from the point of view of those instincts, or those urges and those demands of your own nature, not somebody's nature. These things are not facts with which people are unfamiliar, but even the most rational mind can be stirred to emotion when it can be evoked by certain means. Even a scientific mind can weep and cry due to the emotion which can be stirred up by certain conditions. So it does not mean that we are always rational, 100%. But it also does not mean that we will not exert our reason, our rationality. That also comes and demands recognition sometime, irrespective of your emotional enthusiasms. So, a lot of time may have to be spent in a calculated preparation for this arduous task, the drawing up of a statistical balance sheet, you may say, of every function and every factor in our complicated personality. We are not simple persons as we look. We are very complicated beings. We are made up of as many complications as there can be in the world or anywhere, because we are a miniature of the cosmos. We have within us all the wonders and miracles and problems that the world can have. And we cannot merely ignore these existences within us. I have been repeatedly telling that inside factors are as important as outside factors, because the powers that are within can stir up powers without, and these are what they call the obstacles in the practice of yoga. What you call the obstacles in meditation are only the counterparts of inner forces that are stirred up externally. And therefore, we must be able to realize in our own selves to an appreciable extent what are the powers within us and what are the forces that are likely to be worked up into activity when we exert a pressure upon them or force them to take a particular direction of activity. At present, you see, the mind is used to confuse the action because we give it a free hand, a long rope, and it can move in any way, doing anything it likes at any time. We are slaves of the mind at the present moment. But when you take to the practice of yoga, you do not wish to be a slave of the mind, but wish to control it. And therefore you exert a pressure upon it by the force of will. That is called concentration. And compel it to move in a particular direction and not in the directions it likes or in those directions in which it used to move previously. Then it will also revolt. It will resent your pressure upon it. And it all depends which side will win, whether the pressure you exert upon it is stronger or its resentment is stronger. If you are consistently putting a pressure upon it with sufficient intelligence, knowing the weaknesses of mind and also its powers, then you may succeed. But sometimes your understanding of it may not be adequate to the task. Then it will resent in such a vehemence that it can upset all your efforts. It can break your pot, throw your milk, everything. Then what happens? You will scratch your head, you will start weeping, you will be put out of order in your emotions, in your feelings, you will not sleep, you will not eat, you will not talk, you cannot take a step forward. And you cannot take a step backward. This is likely to be the fate of even an enthusiast on the path of yoga. And therefore, the practices should be very gradual, with a sufficient clarity of the mind in respect of every step that is taken. It is better that we take steps very slowly rather than jump or take quick steps like jumps. Oftentimes it would be advisable to repeat the same step again and again rather than take a second step to see that you are well placed and your first step is firmly fixed. If today you have been taking recourse to a particular method of adjusting the mind to a particular set of thoughts, the same technique may be adopted for a few days instead of advancing further, only to see that whatever has been done properly and it has been successful. It has not been done with haste, because it is only when a pressure is put upon you that your real nature comes out. Otherwise, everything looks very beautiful. Somebody should exert some pressure upon you. Then you see what you are. You will resent it, because nobody likes a pressure. Any kind of pressure is a tendency to put down the ego in a certain measure. And the mind has its own ego. It is the ego itself. Therefore, careful steps have to be taken. And a proper chalked out routine for a few days or a few months ahead, be prepared. And this routine be followed with tenacity. Because it is consistent practice that will bring success. And even a correct practice, not consistently undertaken, will not bring success. Dirgha kala nayantariya sadkara sevito dhrdha bhumihi, says Patanjali. This is a very wise statement in the Yoga Sutras. The practice should be continued for a very, very long time. Dirgha kala. And nairantariya is another term he uses. Without remission of effort, without break in the practice, which means to say that it has to be continued every day. You should not miss it even one day. Even if you are moving in a train, you must sit and see that the practice is not broken. And satkara sevitaha is another appellation that he uses. You must have great love for it. You are not taking the yoga because Guru has told you, or the scripture has declared it, or some pressure has been brought upon you by outside factors. You like it. You have voluntarily taken to it. You have an affection for it. It is dear to you. It is like a mother to you. It is like a father to you. It is everything to you. Such is yoga, which is going to protect you like a father and mother, take care of you as if you are a child. And yoga is not merely an abstract thinking. It is a stirring of forces in the universe which will protect you at all times. Divine forces are roused into action by the practice of yoga. And these forces will act like milch cows, which will yield the necessary sustenance for you. And nobody can take care of you with such complete and comprehensive caution as the powers roused in the practice of yoga. These powers are not merely persons. Though these persons in the world can be used as instruments by these forces, ultimately you will realize there are no persons in this world, there are only forces. Even these persons seated before me are only forces, they are not persons. We have a wrong notion that persons are in front of us. There is no such thing as a person or a thing in this world. Everything is a center of energy. And it is these energies, these centers of force that we are trying to rouse up into a comprehensive action by an all-round technique that we adopt in the practice of yoga. Glorious is the practice. Indispensable it is to every human being. And vigilance is its watchword. Hari Om Tat Sat. God bless you.